official station. You know. Do it.
Anybody there?
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation too to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind. flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. We pour libation to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve. And at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent. Leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diasporas, both objects of a global myopia that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that described them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation too to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jaliyah. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, our shame. Pour libation to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach, and you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, for they will call your name in all eternity. To our children, we pour libation. Ashe, Ashe, Asheo.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people what they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
This piece that I'm about to perform is called Black Boys Round Here, and it's pretty much, it explains the experience of black boys in America, from Jordan Davis to Trayvon Martin to people like me, Keon, Jamon, and the rest of the black men in here. So without further ado, I'd like to say thank you. Black boys around here.
It seems like we're the only ones that come with nicknames, and even our real names are nicknames that don't reflect from which we came. We are bilingual. We speak English and we speak bang, bang. So every shot that rang is a sign of endearment and an expression of pain. And though we ought to be ashamed, shame don't come round here. Only blame come round here. We got so much heart round here. Our hearts beat black drums when blue and white beat black boys round here. Round here. Round here you can hear echoes from the ghettos as the streets remain hollow from the absence of fathers. But no worries though. Media replaces our fathers with Chief Keef and Soulja Boy. Yes, the world is on your shoulders, boy, and you bet not drop it. Round here, we were taught that our savior has blue eyes and our roots started with slavery, and you expect us to be kings round here. Drug dealers are our only visible heroes round here. We can live, have our music loud, and not die round here, Jordan Davis. We can wear our hoodies, eat our Skittles, and not die round here, Trayvon Martin. You take away our history, you take away our soul, you take away our fathers, you take away our jobs, you take away our food, and what we gonna do? We gonna celebrate over soul food round here. You see, we improvise round here. We emperors round here. Black buying power will soon be $1.1 trillion. And just imagine if we invested that round here. We would go back to ancient Africa round here. We wouldn't feel the need to kill to survive round here. If we stop trying to fit into the America's dream, it would become America's nightmare round here. Round here. Black boys, round here. It seems like we're the only ones that come with nicknames. And even our real names are nicknames that don't reflect from which we came. We are bilingual. We speak English and we speak bang, bang. So before you pass blame, I dare for you to come round here and see how black boys are treated round here. It ain't easy round here. I'm not making excuses, but it ain't easy round here. Black boys. Black boys round here.
You need to put that in your music. Come on. And who are the poor enemies? The 85%.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank Thursday edition. We were not on the air on Tuesday of this week due to some technical difficulties, so we decided to broadcast this evening on our Thursday edition. But this will be the last Thursday that we will have this time open to do as we wish. We have a host that will be taking over this program beginning next Thursday, and I'm going to actually let him tell you about his program and to the name of it and give you some idea of what to listen for. Hopefully it will be just as exciting as our other Black Reality Think Tank programs on Tuesday and Saturday. So anyway, thank you so much again for all of you for being here and for your support, your continued support. We really appreciate you. We could not do it, or we would not be here if it were not for you. So we thank you so much for that for your participation. I understand on Tuesday, even though that we were not able to broadcast, that you had a dynamic conversation on the telephone end of our broadcast, and you were able to talk and still share some ideas. And I think that that's wonderful, and I'm loving that among the Black Reality Think Tank family. So thank you again so much for that. Tonight, we want to talk a little bit about activism. This has been a very strange week for us here at the Black Reality Think Tank. We may have had some interference in our system. Not sure why and where it's coming from, but it's been difficult. If some of you are trying to go online and look, listen to some of the programs from before, particularly the one that we did on the Vice President and the brother out of South Carolina, you will not be able to hear that. That has been removed by someone somewhere. And also there was another program that came on that had also been removed. And we're not quite sure. We're not trying to get to the bottom of that, but I have gotten some calls that they were trying to listen to some of our programs, and they're not there. So we're going to make an attempt to try to put them back up so that you can hear. But it's just interesting. And I guess these are just difficult times that we're living in. It's getting to a point where we don't know who to trust anymore. We know who to trust in some cases, and we know who we should never trust. But it's getting more intense. And as the world begins to crumble, and it is crumbling, you got ongoing war in the Middle East has always been there, but recently it has escalated between the Palestinians and the Israelis, getting very ugly over there. I was listening to the earlier news today and the number of deaths and killing, and then obviously COVID, which is dominating our conversations and dominating our life. You know, whether to wear the mask, not wear the mask, get vaccinated, not get vaccinated. It's just a ball of confusion. And so hopefully that programs like what we're doing here can give us an opportunity to talk about it and share our ideas and thoughts about all of these differences. And hopefully we can stay safe as a people, as a community, and keep ourselves together. This is the African way anyway. That is what the African village has always done. So very clearly, we want to see if we can continue that. And I'm so happy that the Black Reality can continue to do that. If you could mute your telephone, your mic, I'd greatly appreciate it. Sometimes those sounds come through. We can open back up in a little while for our conversation. But the other thing I wanted to mention, that this, as I said, this is a think tank. And what only thing that we are doing here is we were trying to bring together our community and our people to talk about things that affect us and our families, and talk about them in a way that maybe some solution could be driven. You know, we because of the COVID, we haven't been able to get together like we want to. We haven't been able to gather in places, person to person. Lately, it's just so many Zoom telephone calls and conference calls and this, but still we need to continue to talk. We don't want to not be able to communicate with each other. Our children are going to school virtually, and now they're beginning to go back, and there's all kind of problems with that and their ability. I'm wondering how much of this has taken away from the development of their education. And so as a family, we need to come together and discuss that. And that's what the Black Reality Think Tank was designed to do, is to bring us together. And I feel comfortable that we are doing that in some cases. And we are talking about those hard discussed matters. Sometimes those things you don't like to talk about. And it's not an attempt to isolate anybody or pinpoint or create a friction or to start something. It's just about survival. And that's what we're doing. And so, again, thank you for continuing to participate with us. Come more, invite others to come and talk. Let's discuss these things and discuss them. We may have differences of opinions. We may not agree with everything. That's okay. But just we need to still do it and need to still say it. We're not going to get everybody to agree with us. And so I just wanted to preliminarily mention that again, as we see the world tightening up. The summer is coming, no telling what's going to happen. Prayerfully that it will not be anything catastrophic, that our young black boys will be able to safely enjoy the summer and not run into problems that we have seen over the last 5, 6, 7 months. So tonight I want to talk about a brother who lived during the times when it was just like this. It was all kind of difficulties and challenges and segregations and lynchings and killings and police shootings and poverties and on and on and on. But because he was a man that was concerned about his community, he stood up and he created programs and he created platforms to be able to address the problems as an activist. He was able to create systems that he wanted to challenge the system and things that they were doing, and he was not fearful of doing that. And some believe and some have argued that he is probably the greatest activist of the 20th century, the greatest African-American activist of the 20th century. He is the one that ushered in the civil rights movement, and he stood as a bulwark for making decisions that relate to a better life for African people. So we're going to talk tonight about Asa. His name is Asa Philip Randolph. And he is known a lot more than just the sleeping car porters. That was just a part of what he did. And we're going to talk about some of that tonight. Okay, as always, we want to do our ancestral profile, and I'm going to do tonight an ancestral profile that is relevant to our discussion. And this is, you didn't hear too much about her, but, you know, she is a very powerful sister. And we give her the honor and the praise. Her name is Lucille Campbell Green Randolph. Lucille Campbell Green Randolph. She was born in 1883, and she transitioned to the ancestral world in 1963. She was born Lucille Campbell on April 15, 1883, in Christiansburg, Virginia. Green was the second of three children of William and Josephine Campbell. She was a graduate of Howard University in Washington, D.C., and she worked as a hairstylist in an upscale New York salon. She was the wife of the labor leader, A. Philip Randolph, and remained his partner until her death. Green was trained as a school teacher at Howard, and she married her first husband, a law student named Joseph Green. And after the two graduated, sadly, Joseph died shortly after their new life in New York City started. After Joseph's death, Green gave up her teaching goals and enrolled in Lelia Beauty College, which was founded in 1913 by Madam C.J. Walker. And after graduating from the first class at the academy, Green started her own salon on 135th Street, attracting an elite clientele. Her business venture would help her future husband, A. Philip Randolph, immensely in his activist projects. Randolph described his wife as beautiful, gregarious, elegant, and her greatest love was for her people. They met when Green was 31 and he was 25. Both of them loved Shakespeare and participated in a small amateur performance group called Ye Friends of Shakespeare in Harlem. They called each other Buddy. During their brief courtship, they mostly went to political talks and stage shows because Randolph had an aversion to the socialite parties that Madam C.J. Walker hosted. They married in November of 1914 at St. Philip's Episcopal Church, a compromise that the couple had to make because Randolph did not want a church wedding. But Green insisted that it would preserve her reputation in social circles. Their honeymoon, at Randolph's request, was simple. It was an open car ride down Manhattan along the East River from their apartment to South Ferry. Green and her husband shared a passion for socialism. Green, a member of the American Labor Party, ran for a seat on the New York City Board of Aldermen on the Socialist Party ticket. Her public activities included being an organizer for a fund for poor children called Harlem Fresh Air and Founding. She was a part of the Harlem branch of the Howard University Alumni Association. She funded and distributed her husband's socialist newspaper called The Messenger at her salon. The New York Post, in a eulogy of Green, stated that Green seems entitled to the honor of being called the one-time second most dangerous Negro in America, having funded her husband's subversive newspaper. She also encouraged Randolph when he was asked to be the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in 1925. Her income kept the two afloat until 1936 because he did not receive a regular salary from that post until then. Asa Philip Randolph warmly acknowledged the debt he owed to his wife for having financially and emotionally supported him when his political career was started. He stated, "We were on an uncharted sea, but I had a good wife. She carried us." When Lucille was asked whether she was bothered by the attention her husband received from women on his national tours, she would reply, "Let them dry," knowing Randolph was faithful to her. During the last 10 years of her life, Green was confined to a wheelchair due to arthritis. Her husband gave her the best medical care possible to make her comfortable, to make sure that she only ate the best food and read by her bedside the day's paper or Shakespeare's every night he was home. Lucille Campbell Green Randolph died on April the 12th, 1963, 4 months before her husband's March on Washington, which was considered his most significant achievement. All right. Thank you so much. It's always interesting in doing the ancestry profiles how many people are connected to other great folks in history and how they were all interacting together, it appeared, and that they were, in many cases, friends and colleagues, and they supported each other. I've always looked at it. I've often wondered what it was like for Booker T. Washington, even though he did not meet Marcus Garvey. Garvey knew of his work, but he, Du Bois, Carter G. Woodson, George Washington Carver, Asa Randolph, all of them at some point were together. They were contemporaries of things. And I often wondered how was their meeting together? How did they discuss things? How did they support each other? And then you also in the backdrop you have people like Murray Church Terrell, Murray McLeod Bethune, and a lot of women, very, very powerful women, that were operating. And there always seems that, from what I've understood as a historian, that it was supportive to other programs. The women had their program, the men had their program, and they were both supported. Now, I'm sure that there were some differences here along the way, and I mean, we've heard of some. There were arguments about what women should do here, even up until the civil rights years. There was a big argument about if there were going to be any women that would speak at the March on Washington. And most of the men felt that they shouldn't. And so the only female voice we heard at the March on Washington was Mahalia Jackson and singing the song she did right before King came on. I think it's important for us to look at now as a blueprint, as a platform about working together. That's one of the biggest problems that I think we have in our community is being able to work together peacefully, realizing and recognizing each other's differences, that we all don't have to agree, but you can do your part, I'll do my part, and it builds to the whole. That's a hard agenda to push. It's very, very difficult, very challenging. And so tonight I thought I would look at this brother, Asa Randolph, Asa Randolph, Asa T. Randolph, just give him my doing two or three different things while I'm talking at the same time. But nevertheless, he is he's a very strong brother, and he's a very powerful activist. And he crisscrossed with everybody during those early years. And so we wanted to kind of look at him tonight to see if there's some things that we can borrow from that type of work, type of leadership. So what I think I'll do first is I will just give you a little bit of the background of my brother. He's done so many things, but I thought I'd give you something that maybe we can just kind of look at and use as a backdrop. A. Philip Randolph brought the gospel of trade unionism to millions of African-American households. And the name of our program tonight is The Gospel According to Asa Philip Randolph. Well, he brought that gospel of trade unionism to millions of African-American households. Randolph led a 10-year drive to organize the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And he served as the organization's first president. Randolph directed the March on Washington movement to end employment discrimination in the defense industry. He did that before the one in 63. And a national civil disobedience campaign to ban segregation in the armed forces. And so when Roosevelt and Eisenhower had to make those decisions, Truman to segregate, to integrate that, that was Asa Hilliard. I mean, he keeps saying Asa Hilliard. Asa Philip Randolph that was pushing that agenda to have that done. And I think a lot of people didn't recognize that how hard he worked. He worked behind the scenes in a lot of ways. He is the one that came up with the idea of a nonviolent protest and mass action effort. And he's the one that put that together to help fight for some of the areas in unions for African people. Unions have always been looked down very negatively in America. They say it's too much like socialism, Marxism. But nevertheless, it has been one of the strongest forces for getting the working persons the benefits and the opportunities that they need to have. Randolph was born April 15, 1889, in Crescent City, Florida. And he was the second son of the Reverend James William Randolph, who was a tailor and an ordained minister in the AME Church, and Elizabeth Robinson Randolph, who was a skilled seamstress. In 1891, the family moved to Jacksonville, Florida, which had a thriving, well-established African-American community. From his father, Randolph learned that color was less important than a man's character and his conduct. From his mother, he learned the importance of education and defending oneself physically. If necessary, Randolph remembered vividly the night his mother sat in the front room of their house with a loaded shotgun across her lap while his father tucked a pistol under his coat and went off to prevent a mob from lynching a man in the local county jail. My kind of people. Asa and his brother, James, were superior students. The Randolph brothers attended the Cookman Institute, which later became a part of the Bethune-Cookman College in East Jacksonville. For years, the only academic high school for African Americans in Florida. Randolph excelled in literature, drama, public speaking. He starred on the school's baseball team, sang solos with his choir, and was valedictorian of the 1907 graduating class. After graduation, Randolph worked at odd jobs, and he devoted his time to singing, acting, and reading. A bolt of lightning hit him, he said, when he picked up a book by a man named W.E.B. Du Bois called The Souls of Black Folk. And that book, he said, convinced him that the fight for social equality was more important than almost anything else. He moved to New York City in 1911 to become an actor, but he gave up after failing to win his parents' approval. Columbia University student Chandler Owen, another sharp brother, shared Randolph's intellectual interests and became his close friend and collaborator. in 1914. Randolph courted and married, as we said earlier, Lucille Green, who supported him in everything that he did. Randolph joined the Socialist Party and began to hobnob with crowds of the Harlem's was called the Soapbox Corner, which was 135th Street and Lenox Avenue. That's the same corner that Malcolm used to speak. Muhammad Ali used to speak and go in those corners and run it down. mainly Malcolm did that, or 135th and Lenox. But Randolph did it about socialism and the importance of the militant class consciousness. In January of 1917, William White, who was president of the Head Waiters and the Side Waiters Society of Greater New York, asked them to edit a monthly magazine for the society called the Hotel Messenger. Randolph and Chandler Owen dropped the hotel from the masthead, and it became known as the Messenger, which soon became known as one of the most brilliantly edited magazines in the history of American Negro journalism. And that is true. You can still get a copy of it from the archives of libraries. There are databases that still have that. You can go to the JSTOR, J-S-T-O-R, which is the acronym for one of the largest databases for journals and publications of that nature. And you can get a copy and take a look at the Messenger and look at some of the articles that he were printed there. And this was pre the Journal of Negro History, and it was post Du Bois magazine that he did, called the one for the NAACP. But nevertheless, the Messenger, it became one of the most brilliantly edited magazines in African American journalism. The magazine provided an outlet to those who liked Randolph and Owen, who were opposed to both the cautious elitism of the NAACP and the utopian populism of Marcus Garvey's United Negro Improvement Association. So as you can see, there are some agreements that people have with each other, but they still work together. By now establishing figures in the Socialist Party in New York, Randolph and Owen embarked on a nationwide anti-war speaking tour in 1918 that brought them to the attention of the U.S. Department of Justice, J. Edgar Hoover, and almost got them arrested. In June of 1925, a group of Pullman porters, and this was the first, and actually now the Pullman porters were the first all-black service staff of the Pullman sleeping cars. And that's an interesting history in the owner of Pullman. Well, that's for another discussion, but it's very interesting how that company, those cars and some of those other magnates worked together, you know, in building places like New York. They approached Randolph and asked him to lead their new organization, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. Randolph agreed. Beside his abiding interest in and his knowledge of the unions, Randolph's primary qualification for the job was his reputation for incorruptibility and the fact that he was not a Pullman Company employee, meaning that the company could not fire him or buy him off. For the next 10 years, Randolph led an artist campaign to organize the Pullman Porters, which resulted in the certification of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters as the exclusive collective bargaining agent of the Pullman Porters in 1935. Randolph called it the very first victory of Negro workers over a great industrial corporation. So you see why A. Philip Randolph is such a powerful brother. And he did this like stuff behind the scenes. It wasn't like he was out there every day in newspapers, and at that time it would not have been television, but, you know, radio and so forth. Randolph became the most widely known spokesperson for black working class interests in the country. In December of 1940, with President Franklin Roosevelt refusing to issue an executive order banning discrimination against black workers in the defense industry, and trust me, that was a million plus industry at that time. They were dealing with the Korean War, World War II, so much, and I mean, it was the military industrial complex building around that time. So it was big money in that area. But Randolph called for 10,000 loyal Negro American citizens to march on Washington, D.C. The support grew so quickly that soon he was calling for 100,000 marchers to converge on the Capitol. And he was, Roosevelt went in shivers when he heard about that. So he was pressed to take action. So what Roosevelt did, he issued an executive order on June the 25th, 1941, 6 days before the march was to occur, declaring there should be no discrimination in the employment of workers in defense industries or governments because of race, creed, color, or national origin. Home run. Roosevelt also set up the Fair Employment Practices Commission to oversee the order. All done by the energy of Chandler Owens and A. Philip Randolph. 6 years later, after the passage of the Selective Service Act of 1947, Randolph demanded that the government integrate the armed forces. Now, you getting ready to bring all the black soldiers into the military and working and doing all that crap they did? Well, you integrate, give them opportunities. So he founded an organization called the League for Nonviolent Civil Disobedience Against Military Segregation. And he urged young men, both black and white, to refuse to cooperate with a Jim Crow conscription service. And that one really put him on the spot, because he was threatened with widespread civil disobedience and needing the black vote in his 1948 reelection campaign. President Harry Truman, therefore, on July 26, 1948, ordered an end to military discrimination as quickly as possible. And see, that has always been an effective tool, because you must remember, America has to window dress its politics. It has to show the rest of the world that it is a peace-loving, democratic, practicing country, and that everybody in America has a fair chance, and this is why we're telling you to have a fair chance. Well, they can't say that if you got a military force where black folks cleaning the bathroom and mopping the floors and cooking, and the white men are running administrative work, and the captains and lieutenants and generals and so forth and so on. And so that's why it became very important to do that. That even went right on up until the Lyndon Johnson years of the Civil Rights Movement. But nevertheless, the March on Washington movement and Randolph's call for civil disobedience to end segregation in the armed forces helped convince the next generation of civil rights activists that nonviolent protests and mass demonstrations were the best way to mobilize public pressure. Randolph was, in this sense, the true father of the civil rights movement in the United States. The movement recognized his role by naming him the chair of the 1963 March on Washington, at which Martin Luther King Jr. gave his infamous speech, "I Have a Dream." And by heeding his advice to cooperate in keeping the march nonviolent, Randolph was elected a vice president of the newly merged AFL-CIO in 1955. And what Randolph did is he used his position to push desegregation and respect for civil rights inside the labor union as well as outside. He was one of the founders of the Negro American Labor Council, and he served as its president from 1960 to 66. In 1964, he was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Lyndon Johnson. He retired as president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in 1968. Randolph was named the president of the recently formed A. Philip Randolph Institute, which was established to promote trade unionism in the black community. He continued to serve on the AFL-CIO Executive Council until 1974. A. Philip Randolph died in New York City on March 16, 1979. And so he learned that those pressure points, those to get those sensitive areas of power and squeeze them, he put that Frederick Douglass piece in operation, about the demand, and you have to give demand to get what you want. And it has to be done in a sensitive way. It has to be done where it hurts them, where you have no choice. It's like in the Godfather movie, make him an offer he can't refuse. It's that kind of thing that we do. And that's what was done in a lot of cases along those years. The A. Philip Randolph Institute is still at work, run by a woman. It's still doing labor union work, even though it has been a lot of effort to break up labor unions now and to make sure that that type of thing doesn't happen, like you see in the Amazon stuff where, you know, in the McDonald's where they refuse to hire union workers and so forth. Well, that doesn't mean that the pressure still is not on, because there are other unions that are just as powerful. And I can recall years coming up in New York City watching how those unions worked and how they could shut down an entire city, such as the Transit Workers Union. Every January the 1st, the transit workers, if they didn't get their strike, get their contract done, they would call a strike. And the subways would go on strike at January the 1st. So if you were out partying December 31st, January 1st, you may not be able to get home. And I recall one that they did pull. They did call the strike, and it did happen. People were trying to walk across the George Washington Bridge, getting back up into the Bronx from Manhattan. Traffic everywhere, because traffic in New York is bad anyway. All because the transit union pulled that strike, and that means everybody goes off. And what affects, and see the connecting power of that, the union, and I know I'm not saying anything new to anybody, but if the transit union workers go on strike, some of the other unions that are supportive of that go on strike too. And so you've got maybe four or five strikes going on. That's what happened when the teachers union in New York went on strike. And it started out of a conflict in Brooklyn called the Brooklyn-Brownsville teachers strike. And those teachers walked out. But what it affects, because they are under that AFL-CIO ban, that means any union under that ban could choose to also refuse to cross the picket line. So if there was something that was needed in the schools, if they found teachers from somewhere else, you wouldn't be able to get lunch, you wouldn't be able to get anybody to work on the lights, turn on the heat, because all of those were controlled by unions, and they may call a strike as well. And that was the kind of support they did. A. Philip Randolph was behind that type of thing as it related to African-Americans. One of the things that he did, he worked very closely with Marcus Garvey. He didn't necessarily like black nationalism, but in the 20s, he had his first confrontation with black nationalism in the form of Marcus Garvey. He had a chance to talk with him. Randolph actually introduced Garvey to the soapbox scene, going out on the corner 135th and Lenox and talking. He's the one that told him to do that. Though they clearly had different political viewpoints. However, though, the relationship quickly became a bitter personal rival. Garvey's program called for the eventual return of all black people to Africa to create their own empire and the building of black business. He said, you can't do it here in America. I don't care what you do. I don't care how many or unions you organize. You're not going to get that done here. That's the same argument we hear today. You need to get the heck up out of here and go back to Africa. Well, this was fused with a militant racial and cultural pride that captured the imagination of a million people, though. People were being moved by what Garvey was saying. And so the broader social context made it more likely that Garvey's movement would become actually bigger than A. Philip Randolph's movement. And so they were battling. And then at the same time, in the same line of, you know, you got Du Bois and his argument that's still a part of this whole thing. This is all going on at the same time in New York City. There was intense racial conflict over jobs and housing and ensued immediately after the war. There was something that happened in 1919. It was called the Red Summer. The Red Summer of 1919 saw a wave of race riots and lynchings across the country. There were no signs that black workers would be accepted in the labor movement, and socialism did not seem like a real prospect. So reflecting on these years, Randolph said, what you need to follow Garvey was a leap of imagination. He said, but socialism and trade unionism call for rigorous social struggle, hard work, and programs. And few people wanted to think about that. So against the emotional power of Garveyism, what I was preaching didn't stand a chance. That's what Randolph said. Randolph saw Garvey as a charlatan. They began to disrespect each other, thinking his program was unrealistic and lacked class content. Randolph started a Garvey Must Go campaign when it was revealed that Garvey held a secret meeting with the Ku Klux Klan. And he published bitter polemics against black nationalism in his magazine, The Messenger, which had a very wide reading audience. It said things escalated to the point where Randolph received several human hands in the mail. I don't know where it came from, but he received several human hands in the mail. The campaign against the Garvey movement was instructive for Randolph. He saw that despite the incredible enthusiasm and organization it generated, the black nationalist movement petered out and was not viable. However, Randolph also seemed out of step with the times. You know, his whole post-war repression had disseminated the socialist left, and by 1925, the Messenger magazine had really began to decline in its readership. Not one of the unions or organizations Randolph created had survived. Well, you know the reason why is the immigrants were flooding over here from Europe. And they were coming over biased, undereducated, unintelligent, and you were clashing with each other, you know, particularly in New York, in major, major ways. So, in a sense, the Pullman Porter situation was a big help. Whites didn't want that job. They didn't want to be waiting on people in railroad cars. They didn't want to be taken away from their families and have to travel for long periods of time. So they weren't kind of going after those kind of jobs. Those were your servant. Yes, sir, boss. How you doing, boss? You know, you want what you? What can I buy you? They saw that as demeaning, and they didn't want to approach that. So in a stroke of luck, Randolph was approached by the Pullman car porters who had read The Messenger, and they wanted Randolph to help the car porters organized. So these porters worked for the Pullman Company, and they worked on those luxury dining cars, tending to the needs of white customers. It was considered, like I said, a demeaning job. However, it was one of the better jobs for black people could get. But it came at a bad price. The porters had to scramble for the tips, and the passengers called all of them George. And they called him after the company owner, whose name was George Pullman, which is an interesting character, too. Their monthly wages started at $72.50, but required around 400 hours of labor a month. The Pullman Company was so powerful, it was hard to imagine black workers could ever organize. So for Randolph, this was a chance to prove that labor unionism could be a way for black workers to advance and to win not just greater economic security, but a modium of respect and dignity. Randolph, as I said, we said earlier, he founded the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in 1925 and spent 12 long years fighting the company for recognition. Pullman used three main weapons against the union group and Randolph. He got workers to spy on each other, layoffs, and anti-union elements within black institutions. The spies were so effective, the union often had to operate in secret. All the important forces within black life seemed to be on the side of the bosses. The dean of Howard University came out publicly against the Negro unionism, and most black churches wouldn't let speakers from the porters' unions use their platform, and black newspapers denounced the organizing effort. Now, the question I'm sure you're asking is, why did it do that? Well, let's get to it. See, after the initial enthusiasm and growth, the Great Depression seemed to wipe out any chances of the union's success. But the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters went from a membership of 7,000 in 1928 to just 771 in 1932. And the workers that stayed loyal made enormous economic and personal sacrifices to do so. Union bosses endured hardships like torn apart families, evictions, and having to pawn off precious possessions. Even Randolph often couldn't afford the train fare to his next city, and the union would have to pass the hat to pay for his ticket. It was common to see Randolph speaking at meetings in tattered clothes and wearing shoes without soles. However, the pro-labor New Deal legislation of Roosevelt re-energized the labor movement, including the porters. It also made a lasting impression on Randolph about the opportunities that could be opened by government action. So when the election between the company union and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters finally took place, the Brotherhood won by a margin of 7,000 votes. In a last-ditch effort, the Pullman Company sent Randolph a six-figure check in exchange for having give up the fight. Randolph, of course, set the check back. In August of 1937, exactly 12 years after the union was formed, they negotiated an agreement that reduced the work month from 400 hours to 240 and almost doubled the porter's wages. These efforts proved that forming unions was the most viable way for black working people to advance. Randolph did the impossible, and overnight, he became the country's most important black union leader and political figure. And one of the reasons that so many people were harsh about the sleeping car porters is because, again, they called it demeaning. But however, during the time that they started, they were some of the highest paid black workers that there were. Most of the sleeping car porters were college graduates because they couldn't find jobs in other places. So these were well-trained men. They were able to amass very good tips from some whites, you know, I guess by buffooning ways and holding conversations that amazed them. And so some cases they would tip them. But these were very well-paying jobs, and to the point that a lot of people in the black community became jealous over the sleeping car porters and were opposed. And so when husbands would come home, they would say that their wives had been blocked out and had been talked about in the neighborhood and so forth and so on, that your husband probably got thousands of women all over the place and just spread a lot of kind of discontent, so that when the husbands did come home, they wouldn't meet problems. But that was only because of the jealousy that occurred, because the sleeping car porter, they had steady work. They could work, they could be assured of a paycheck, and it was decent pay for those times, for black folk in those years. So a lot of the Pullman porters had homes. They bought houses, and they were able to have transportation, you know, and things of that nature that made them stand out. So people were against it, and a lot of folk came after them. And one of the ones that had shocked me was the black press. I was so surprised that I would think that a Sinstack paper would have done that, or the Norfolk Journal and Guide or something like that would have attacked a working group of men who come together and work and obviously to take care of their families would be ridiculed by the black community. So I'm going to hold there because I want to go to our audience and see who's here and kind of talk a little bit about that kind of activism. And do we have that kind of activism today? Is it still around? Is it still necessary? That type of reaction that A. Philip Randolph would do, who is an example of something like that now? What blocks us from having that? Working together is another question that I want to put on the table. Why is it that we can't work together? What do we need to do to try to bridge that gap? And some of those kinds of things that we want to talk about sort of to better our students. So I'm going to go over here to my good brother. He was the first one online, Brother Timothy. How you doing, Brother Timothy?
Brother, I like this conversation. I knew something about Randolph, right? I didn't know as much as you told me.
Yes.
I didn't know about his wife. But every time I think of Randolph, I think of socialism, which is a very good program once it's put together and put into effect. And when I think of him, I think about the March on Washington. I think about Barrett Rustin. I think about Roy Wilkins. But here's the thing that I want people to understand. Because working in a school district, we have unions. But he was a union leader.
Yes, he was.
That's the difference between just being a politician. Now, you have some people who are union leaders, and they leave and get into politics. But those union leaders who once were union leaders, when they bring into politics, they don't use the politics right. You know, let me give you an example. In Philadelphia, we have struck as teachers in the public school district.
Uh-huh.
That our union has not been as strong as it used to be. Now, my thing is that when the unions get together and we say that we want to strike, we always wanted the public transportation system to strike with us.
Right.
We also wanted the nurses to strike with us. So you have that unity strike, you shut down the city.
Mm-hmm.
I always say that if you can't shoot them down, shut them down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Shut them down, right? That's right. You say shut them down. Mm-hmm. You can't shoot them down, shut them down, right?
Mm-hmm.
So listen, we as teachers did a few things, but what happens is collective bargaining, and sometimes the union leader backs off.
Right.
But you got to take it to them. And what happens is they pay off the politician to say, slow the teachers down. And what the politicians have done, at the midnight hour, because remember, public schools were once a state issue,
right,
is that a state rep, what he did, said, if teachers strike over a week, and they always use the child is home by himself, the mother and father's not there. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So get the parents to strike with us. Make sure they bring water and bread for us when they need it. Let them know that the child's not going to get a proper education, not let them all work together. Get the parents involved. But a politician actually put in legislation to say, if you strike over a week, you lose your certification.
Right.
I said, oh, my God, right. I be DAM. I'm not going to curse. I say, I be DAM. Listen to this. Now, that's the problem. So listen to me. I'm saying to you, that's what I like about socialism and unionism. Now, I'm a nationalist, but I could use socialism and unionism on that level.
Right.
And let me tell you something. And socialists can use nationalism on certain levels.
And they do.
So we
got to
work
they
together
do.
In this thing.
They do.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So I'm saying to you, a true union leader is good. And a true politician who's real about change will work with a socialist. This is what my man is saying in the crisis of the Negro.
Right.
That the nationalists can work with the socialists.
Okay.
Matter of fact, some nationalists, if you look at it, work in socialist areas and don't realize it. And some socialists work in a nationalist way.
That's right.
If you they don't want to look at it like that.
If you look at the definition of democratic socialists, that's where you begin to see. There are a lot of governments today run on democratic socialism. Wisconsin, Milwaukee has had a democratic socialist mayor.
Very good. If you hear Cornel West, he'll tell you, I'm a democratic socialist. Cornel West is the first one to say it.
Right. That's right.
That's right. That's right.
That's it.
So I'm for unionism. I'm for unions. And I'm for nationalism. But I'm truly a nationalist.
I got you.
Because after a while, when it gets down to true socialism, there's some things that when it comes to nationalism, that is not going to fit in our equation.
Right.
It's just not going to fit.
Okay.
You see, I can only take it so far. Now, some people could say, well, I'm not going to give up my nationalism from the socialists. I'll tell you that now.
Mm-hmm.
But I will work with the socialists. Now, you got some socialists that want to fight a nationalist. Matter of fact, that was the fight of Malala Karenga and Huey B. Newton.
Right.
Karenga's organization was us people. Huey's organization was socialism, Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't get along, right?
Yeah,
they didn't get along.
Yeah,
and but they have to get along. Black people have to learn how to survive under the same roof. Right. If nobody don't, we do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
There ain't no
I like it. I like that.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brother Timothy.
All right.
Before we take a top of the hour break, I want to say that, you know, this week, as you know, this is our Thursday edition. We've had this position vacant for quite a while, you know, it's interesting that we have now filled that position, and we're going to have next Thursday, you'll hear a different voice for a while. He is going to be producing a program. He is familiar to us in the Black Reality Think Tank family. So I'm going to let him come on and tell us a little bit about his program. Maybe if he knows already what he's going to be doing next Thursday, he can tell us about that. And then we're going to go to the top of the hour break. So, Brother Kwazi, how you doing tonight?
Hey, I'm doing all right, Dr. Rogers. I'm
good.
Doing all right.
Good, good.
Hey, Brother Kwazi.
Hey, Sister Dede and Brother Timothy.
It's always a pleasure, family. It's a pleasure, family.
What's happening, Brother Timothy?
Hey, it's a pleasure, Dee Dee. It's a pleasure, my brother. We had a good conversation with Brother Lush. You know, Dee Dee, we got to get together.
Yes,
let's talk.
Yeah,
Dr. Rogers puts us all together. It's a one good big family. We
That's
like
right.
to fight, no. We're going to win.
That's true.
And Brother Timothy, like you said, we got to learn how to get along.
Right. We got to get along. Yes, we do. As
you
black
sure
people,
do.
Yes, we do.
So, Brother Kwazi, right. you want to tell us about your program?
Oh. Yes, definitely. You know, I just want to first give thanks to our creator and to Brother Alfonso. I will call him the King Warrior, who kind of directed to the program in regards to the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee.
Right, right.
And so with all my encounters with him and just understanding how we need to navigate through all this. It brought me to the Black Reality Think Tank with Doc Rogers and being part of the shows. And, you know, and I just want everybody to have a voice. And, you know, we've been fighting this fight for a long time. And, you know, we have different strategies and so forth, how we need to operate. So one of the things, in me being not only a fighter for our liberation, but just a fighter in general. That's just how I see things, and so many people out there doing it. So, and we've been, our ancestors have done so much work, so we stand on the shoulders of just greatness. And so the title of the program is going to be Continuing the Fight, because there's nothing we started, but we can sure finish it, and we're not holding back or stopping at all. I mean, all over the country, we read about something
right.
that somebody's doing. In conversation, we're always hearing about something. And we need to just continue, and we know that so many people are fighting, and there's so many different ways that we fight, via writing a letter or just gaining so much knowledge. But I just appreciate so much of what's been going on and listening to this conversation about the Porters. I remember just reading up some of it, and I think that's how we got that information to go on the stock markets and so forth.
Right, right.
You know, they were just talking in front of us, just like we weren't even there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
mm-hmm.
so we have to still learn how to, you know, use those things, because they still do it now.
That's
they
right.
still do it now, just like we don't matter.
Right.
And but like I said, we do matter, and I want everybody's voices heard, so I appreciate everybody that comes in at different times with questions and comments and give us suggestions to continue this fight, and that's what we're going to be talking about.
So your program's called Continuing the Fight, right?
Continuing the Fight.
Okay.
Continuing the Fight.
Thursday evening at 6 o'clock?
From 6 to 8.
6 to 8. 8. Right. Yeah, right here, Time for an Awakening. This we are a call-in format, so you can call us, those of you who might be listening on the Internet, if you want to call and give your comments or suggestions or questions, 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And so tonight we've been talking about the great Asa T. Randolph, and we've been looking at some of his activism that he's done and how it has carried over to today. And we want to definitely continue that discussion. We want to kind of talk a little bit about some of the misnomers about the civil rights movement and the March on Washington. That's a tactic of A. Philip Randolph, the March on Washington. He started that back in the 1940s. And what happened in 63 was just a continuation of his vision and his dream. So we'll come back and talk a little bit about that and look at some of the facts around that. But let's first take a quick break, and we'll come right back, and we are going to finish our conversation. Time for an awakening media lineup. All of our times or Eastern Standard. On Mondays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspective with host Brother Oshie. On Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds with host Brother Jihad Ahmed. On Monday evenings from 8 to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central with hosts Dr. Mawaya Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone. On Monday evenings from 9 to 10 p.m., on the first and third Mondays of each month, Conversation Reparations. Conversation Reparations. On Tuesday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank, with host Dr. William Rogers. On Wednesday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Ocean. On Fridays, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Ocean. From 8 to 10 p.m. on Friday evenings, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot Booker and his co-host Brother Richard. On Saturdays, from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk, with host LaWanda Chambers. And at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday evening, the Sankofa Council of Milwaukee, with host Dr. Janine James, Brother Kwasi Kraft, and Sister D.D. Conley. And on Sunday, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and his co-host Brother Richard. These are our lineup times. We thank you for your patronage, and please, by all means, check us out.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All right, my sisters and brothers, we are back. We are discussing today the activism of the great A. Philip Randolph. And we asked the question, how active is your activism? How active is your activism? And this was definitely a very shrewd brother, very calculating, very strategist, a 100% strategist. And he's done some beautiful work in terms of helping African families and individuals in terms of some of the things he did. We talked to before going on the break about his role within the Defense Department, which had become the largest industry in America at the time, and making sure that African Americans could get a foothold in that industry. And then we also know him as it relates to the March on Washington movement. And he used his union tactics in putting together this march. He saw the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters as the home base of his operations for building a broader political movement. He wanted to expand. As I said, he's an extreme, powerful strategist. Everything he did was anchored in his base, and he leveraged his resources. He stated one time, without the Porters, I couldn't have carried on the fight for fair employment or the fight against racial discrimination in the armed forces. He said, there's no better example of the dynamic work than the March on Washington movement, and what he used those tactics in pulling that together. And you know, the country at that time was transitioning to a war economy in preparation for World War II. Randolph had two things on his mind: making sure that black workers attained good employment in the defense industries and desegregating the armed forces. And he did that with his threat of March on Washington. Black workers were caught in a bind during this time. They could not get hired without training, but the government and the unions were not providing it to them. Randolph saw an opportunity here, and he started with his own home base. He said the union leader got the idea to march 10,000 black people in Washington, D.C. while on a train ride with his top lieutenant, Milton Webster. The infrastructure of the union was used to promote the march. So Randolph conducted a vigorous tour of a lot of the locals of the sleeping car porters to get the members involved, one-on-one, speaking with them, calling them, handshaking, sitting down and say, I need your support. Or porters spread the word wherever they travel on their trains. This was partly a game of strategic bluffing. No one really knew how many people they could get, but the point was to at least make the movement believe it could happen. Randolph knew no president was going to want a mass march just as the country was getting ready to enter a major war. The momentum drew in the mainstream civil rights organizations that didn't want to be outflanked, such as the NAACP and the National Urban League. Still, it has mostly the porters that funded its activities. The mass rallies of thousands were held in major cities, and people even began to speculate whether 100,000 people would go to the march. And remember, as we said earlier, the sleeping car porters were well paid in that day and time, and so a lot of their money they used to do things and help and support organizations. That's why I was totally surprised when I read the research by a scholar who said that they were against A. Philip Randolph and this whole idea. If it had not been for the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the Chicago Defender, and the Baltimore Afro-American, the Pittsburgh Courier, the New York Amsterdam newspapers would not have been able to get distributed all over the country, because they were distributed all over the country through the Sleeping Car Porters group. The newspapers would leave Chicago, throw a couple of bundles of papers on the train, and when the trains pulled into the stations down south, they would take the papers off and make sure that they were distributed through different means and different ways. It got so bad one time that they were beginning to put spies to find out who was doing that, so they would make sure they would lose their job. But these were the kinds of things that they did. So Randolph used this tactic, in this march on Washington as the same way. And then Roosevelt didn't like it, and he issued what he called Executive Order 0082 that created the Fair Employment Practice Commission to prevent discrimination of black workers in the defense industry. He ended up having to do that, as we talked about. And so Randolph would continue, even right on up into the Civil Rights Movement time, to act as an anchor for various civil rights initiatives. He didn't forget about the demand to desegregate the armed forces, as I said, and soon found another opportunity to pursue this. As President Truman was gearing the country up for the Korean War, he was also approaching an election in 1948 where black voters would be crucial. Randolph advocated that blacks refuse the draft. Check this out now. Refuse the draft if the army remained Jim Crow. And he led pickets in the 1948 Democratic National Convention. They picketed the Democrats. There are photographs that are available in a lot of archives showing black folk picking against this in 1948 during the Democratic National Convention to make sure they drive that point home. This was a very popular stance by black folk at the time. This was almost a life-threatening kind of stuff. And so as a poll of young black men in Harlem found that 71% favored the civil disobedience. The New Yorkers did. They favored this. They said, let's do it. And so whereas the president saw Randolph's threat was credible, and so Truman said, we better act on this and we better act on it quick. And as a result, he did. The 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was in many ways the fulfillment of a long-held dream of A. Philip Randolph. And although Bayard Rustin was the main logistical organizer, now here's another brilliant strategist, was Bayard Rustin. He was the main logistical organizer. It could not have come together without Randolph. So Randolph and Rustin together pulled this thing off. He said the labor influence on the demonstration was clear in the demands of full employment, raising the minimum wage and a permanent a job placement for African-American people, workers. Only Randolph had the respect and prestige to navigate the egos and the rivalries of the various civil rights leaders. It's still the same way today. You know, this has killed us as African-American people. But nevertheless, it happens, and these are individuals that showed how to fight that and how to move beyond those things. His deep relationship within the labor union secured crucial funding and logistical support. The march on Washington was not only designed to pressure the federal government on the Civil Rights Act. For Randolph, the mobilization also signaled he wanted to pivot toward a new stage in the labor movement. He saw that as the legal pillars of Jim Crow were struck down, the movement had to take on broader social and economic goals. So he agreed with the Black Power activists. This is a lot of people shocked by this, but it's true. A. Philip Randolph pulled his shoulders together with key Black Power leader activists that claimed the civil rights movement in the South could not deal with the problems Black people were facing in northern ghettos. So they came together to make that statement. Randolph believed that there were structural changes in the economy creating a crisis situation for Black people in urban areas. So therefore, what he did was the struggle could not just be about civil rights. It had to be tied with the problems of political economy. He was especially attuned to the effects automation would have on Black workers, disproportionately locked into unskilled jobs. And so he stressed that these problems would not be solved simply by changing the racial attitude of whites. That means nothing when it comes to political, economic, and social change. They are fundamental economic problems which are caused by the nature of the system in which we live. We got to realize that. In the mid-1960s, Randolph and Bayard Rustin put forward the Freedom Budget. They created something called a Freedom Budget. You ever get a chance, Google it sometime and read that. It was created as a vision of the next stage of the movement. It was a comprehensive program of full employment, housing, raising the minimum wage, national health care, and upgrading Social Security. Sound familiar? Yes, it does. The plan represented nothing less than a radical transformation of the country and was the inverse of more conservative efforts toward local community control. Sadly, however, the Vietnam War and other political factors prevented the Freedom Budget from being enacted. But check this out, sisters and brothers. The deal was, this was a plan put down on paper to be implemented called the Freedom Budget. Now, others were talking about doing it. I remember Martin Luther King said something to the effect that America will never change without a radical redistribution of the wealth. But he said that. That's a statement. What Bayard Rustin and A. Philip Randolph is they put a plan in action. They put a plan together and began to move around the country to get people to support it. But you know the results of what Vietnam did. It depleted the communities. They took husbands away from their families. It just did so many different things that would make that kind of plan not possible, because now all the focus has to be put on fighting that war in Southeast Asia. And so ironically, Randolph was accused of being too moderate during that period. He was promoting the Freedom Budget. The Black Power movement is usually understood as being the more radical alternative at this time. But this interpretation, however, is not accurate either. For example, in 1967, the Black Power Conference in Newark produced a program that included the establishment of neighborhood credit unions, Buy Black campaigns, the creation of Black nonprofits, and cooperative enterprise. The Freedom Budget, on the other hand, aimed at far more transformative redistribution of wealth and resources. The Black Power agenda largely emphasized measures to empower a burgeoning Black business and political class, while Randolph's program sought to build the working class power. And I'm going to stop right there. That's the kind of things that we've got to do now. We've got to look at what our ancestors were doing and proposing, and we'll see that there were differences. There were challenges to what they wanted to do. The Freedom Budget was a hardcore, solid document that was put together by Randolph and Rustin to put into action in our community. And the Black Power agenda had the same thing too. They had hardcore plans on how to radically redistribute the wealth. So, but somehow or the other, it just wasn't going to happen in that way, and not like that. But I'm kind of saying it because this is what must be done in our planning and in our organizing. This is the kind of activism, doing that. So one of the things that what Randolph ended up doing is he started the A. Philip Randolph Institute. After things, the Vietnam War just discipled everything so badly. And Randolph believed at that point that the large-scale problems black faced could only be solved at the federal level. And despite these differences, he said, he always defended the right of black nationalists to express their views and believed they succeeded in giving the country a greater sense of urgency about the issue of that. So he supported the black nationalist agenda. Randolph spent the last 3 years of his life in various activities, including the push to increase building trade apprenticeship for youth of color. And though the political terrain was moving away from his vision, he still spoke at occasional lectures at honorary dinners. He died in his Manhattan apartment on May the 16th, 1979, at the age of 90 years old. A. Philip Randolph, my friends, that's the kind of activism that we've got to see back in place. And I'm not saying that there are people out here who have that kind of vision and do so, but I think we on all levels need to look at that. And if we don't see it, then we need to organize. Brother Timothy, you want to say something?
Yes, sir, brother. I'm going to say this, that when I think of Asa, and when I think of Asa, I think of Powell, because Powell was a councilman for about 3 or 4 years before he ran for Congress. Uh-huh. And Asa was running for Congress also. Uh-huh. But Asa was not aware of the plans of Powell. Now, see, Powell had the experience of being in council. And Asa thought he was going to walk into their seat. When Powell got wind of it, because Powell might have wanted it too, Powell maneuvered him way into that seat. He had the church behind him, which is the government all by
That's
itself.
Exactly
but
right.
Here's the thing.
That's exactly right.
See, that church in Harlem was something else. But now, at the same time, he's developing enemies around him that he don't realize. Because, when they were doing boycotting, Powell was the first one to do it in Harlem before King did it. And I thought that King should have kept up with the boycotts. I'm serious. He was doing good with the boycott. That was successful. He did a nonviolent piece, but I thought the boycotting was great. But what had happened, Powell started doing it first, and he started getting King started getting the attention, and then this develops into Bart Bayard, who Powell didn't appreciate too much, and you can see it because Powell wasn't invited to the March on Washington.
Okay,
Bayard did a lot with that. I mean, he funded it, he made sure things happened. Then you had Asa who organized it, and you had King that spoke. So I'm looking at that whole situation of not getting along again.
Mm-hmm.
And not women speaking. I mean, the women that were active in that time.
Oh, women were powerful at that time. Very powerful.
They were powerful. See, when you exclude your own people, that's bad. Mm-hmm. You got to have your own people at the forefront with mm-hmm. the money,
mm-hmm.
with
mm-hmm.
the organizing, right?
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? We're setting up strategy. That all has to work. Give you another example of what was going on in Philadelphia when I was in elementary school. In our elementary school, the teenagers were dissatisfied with the curriculum. Talking about black people now. They didn't have history. The school district didn't have the books. The facilities weren't always that great. So they went out to the school district, was at 21st and the Parkway at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't at 440 on Broad Street. And what the students did is they protested. And they protested. They didn't get violent. But they had energy. And the former police commissioner, who became the mayor, Rizzo,
right,
came down there in the horses and bully cubs. And you know they actually locked those teenagers up and hit them in the head, mm-hmm. in the Delpster. That's mm-hmm. never forgotten in Philadelphia.
And
that's
Rizzo
never forgotten.
Wasn't no joke.
He wasn't. But guess what? He wasn't no joke. But guess what? I'll tell you, one person he didn't mess with, Cecil B. Moore, who was the attorney from Philadelphia. Let me tell you something. Yeah. But together as black people with Cecil, he could be handled. But you got to get him together. See, and see, here today, in the school district in Philadelphia, no different than no other schools, they're just sitting there, babysitting it, and not getting down to the roots
right.
of it. In other words, they got to deal with a charter school, which is a public school. They got to deal with the problems of the public school, which is the public school. And Philadelphia is not supported by the state anymore. It's by the city. Now, listen to me. That means the mayor and the council people have to deal with it. And can they deal with it? They're dealing with something that all they've been doing is putting Band-Aids on the sore. Band-Aids on the sore. Band-Aids on the sore. Now, you know what? What you really now get to see this when you come with the nationalist piece. The nationalist said, well, let's just get our own schools. And the public school and the charter schools are saying, let's do charter school money to have our own schools.
That's a good point.
And the public schools that want to be backed by the union is saying, we could do it through the public school system. All I'm telling you is that in order to redo this stuff and have it together, black people have to know the curriculum. They have to be supported and funded by the city. And their politicians have to stop selling out. And the union leaders have to stop bending. See, let me tell you something. See, when Mark Shedd was a superintendent, Rizzo couldn't control him.
Right.
That's what you got to get. You got to get a superintendent that's ready to rumble. And guess what? Sometimes you got to go to jail.
That's right. Very good.
And if you can't shoot him down, shed him down.
But you see, but you see why that type of activism that Randolph had was so critical that you sometimes don't see today. His thing was logistical. He was a logistics expert.
Right.
He did it like you do if you were going into the battlefield. The battlefield is a logistical operating system. It's strategized to the right down to the trees and bushes.
Right. And you said he worked in the dark to bring out the light. See, he worked in the dark. You said he worked in the dark to come out to the light. You can't let anybody know what you're doing.
That's right.
Right.
And then you go forward and go out on the battlefield. And then sometimes then people have to know you the general.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean?
And that's why I always say.
You got that. Sometimes you can't be dangerous. You got to be deadly. They don't know when you strike.
Right. You gotta follow that money trail too. You really do. Sister Dee, you wanna say a couple words? Sister Dee?
Pardon me?
Sister Dee?
Oh yes, thank you. You know what? I love this show this evening. And talking about Asa Philip Randolph, when you were talking about that, it reminded me of this movie that I once watched. And it was about when the black people had to work for the, I believe that was the Pullman Railroad, and it said, when the Great Depression struck in America in 1920s, finding work was hard, but if you were poor and black, it was virtually impossible. Working as a porter for the Pullman Railroad Company was an option, but it meant taking home a third of as much as white employees and working 3 days for free. You could forget about being called by your real name. All black porters were simply called George, after George Pullman. He's the one that owned that railroad, the first person employed emasculated slaves.
Right.
Asa Philip Randolph, a black journalist and educator at that time, trying to establish a voice for these forgotten workers, agreed to fight for the Pullman porters. And he fought for them. And then they had called him the most dangerous man in America. Y'all, this movie ain't no joke. The movie is called 10,000 Black Men Named George. Yep. And it's about Asa Philip and these porters when they were struggling back in the
20s. That's a good Dr. film.
Dr. Rogers, you know you hit it right. Dr. Rogers, as you always do, hey, you and Brother Timothy, y'all hit it right on the head. I love this show tonight.
That's good. Thank you.
And I want to say one. You'd be surprised who's on that on those cars. Langston Hughes worked to get his literature out. So many people did that to employment. You know that Langston Hughes, the great author, poet, read all over the world. He had so many people would take that job as a black person to get on their feet. That's how important unionism is.
Right.
But nationalism itself is also great. But unionism,
strong unionism.
That's right.
And I'm going to tell you somebody else we forgot about, too, that was fighting also back in those days, Whitney Young. Now, Whitney Young, he was a fighter, too. And I don't believe that man jumped in the ocean and drowned, because he started getting tired of some of the crap that Johnson and them was pulling.
Well,
but he had a stronger voice, too. And now, he was, yes, Whitney Young. Yeah, Whitney Young Jr.
Yeah, he. You're right. He did. He was a fighter out there. He had some strange ways, though. We don't have time to get into him tonight, but he had some things that he was a little on the strange side, and he didn't get that respect like an A. Philip Randolph would get. See, a lot of A. Philip Randolph's problem, you wonder why he doesn't, is not as important, say, as a Martin Luther King or somebody of that ilk, is that some of that internal black stuff that goes on in our community, light skin, dark skin stuff, and you know, the fact that you got maybe a little bit of money and I don't have none, and so therefore you think you somebody, and I, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's what hurt him. And
like W.E.B. Du Bois was treating Garvey when he called him a gold ruler.
Exactly right. Same right there.
And always talking about how black he was. I don't understand. That's another story too.
That's another program.
Yes.
Brother Lush, how you doing tonight?
Good evening, everyone. I'm still at work right now. I need to get some numbers out for tomorrow. But I'm here, President, accounted for. So I'm just listening in on the conversation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I always appreciate you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very
much. And good evening, everyone.
Good evening. Brother Lush, good evening. Look for my phone call soon. I've been working.
Alrighty.
I've been tired, but look for my phone call soon.
Alrighty.
And you shoot, Sister Dee Dee. Look for my phone call soon.
All right, my brother.
Right.
Okay, and I'm glad to see you all doing that, too. I'm glad to see you, keeping that, the fires burning.
Thanks to you, Doc Rogers.
That's right.
Thank you, Dr. Rogers.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad you're doing that.
He's the hero of the moment and the hour.
Brother Griffin, you wanna add anything to this conversation? You just listening? Brother Griffin, you wanna add anything to the conversation? He's got himself muted. Well, maybe he's just listening. You can come on in if you need to at any point. There he is, okay.
I was just trying to say I got here late, but I'm present for class, I love your show. Love what you're doing.
Right.
I never leave here without some provocative thoughts and looking at that. But I appreciate you, sir.
Okay. Your phone breaking up a little bit, but I can hear something, a little bit of what you're saying. Yes, sir. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Yeah. And, like I said, I wanted to look at him tonight because I really think that the activism of this type is really needed. It's needed more than we've ever done before. Like I said, that A. Philip Randolph Institute still stands. And a woman does run it. You can look it up online. I'm not sure. I believe it operates out of New York City, but you can look it up and look kind of things. But that type of work is very critical. And particularly now, we've lost a lot of our weapons and tools that we use to fight with, like the black newspapers, the black press. We still have black radio, hopefully, that we can still use. And then obviously mediums like this, which will begin to increase more, I think, and people will take advantage of it. I'm not so fruitful about looking at social media, even though I know it is a very powerful tool, and it has been used to do a lot of different things. But I'm not quite sure the impact that that's going to have in terms of any type of liberation fight. But very clearly, though, no doubt about it, we still have to, like I said, we have to use this this mode of, doing things. And because there are so many others out there, we need to also take a look at, and understand the activism. I don't think we've really done a very good job of looking at the activism of the great Fannie Lou Hamer.
I was going to mention that. Yeah. You are so right.
She has an agenda. I mean, this was a sharecropper woman. This was a woman that sixth grade education, where she stopped the Democratic convention.
That's right. Love Fannie Lou Hamer. Yep.
Lyndon Johnson had to offer her a deal to keep her mouth shut.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Yes, sir. Go right here.
And Doc, I'm gonna say Ida B. Wells.
Oh, big time. Ida B. Wells she was using the black press to talk about those lynchings.
Yeah.
And doing some things, and then you know, don't forget the other brother too. I have to admire him, Walter White. Walter White is the reason that you have been able to see those pictures of those lynchings, because what Walter White did is he went through the South with his camera, and he was because he was a very light-skinned man. He looked white. He actually did not look African-American at all. And so he was posed as a white person with a camera and take pictures of all those lynchings. And basically, he was the president of the NAACP.
Well, Doc, I have to say something to you about that, though. You know, Du Bois didn't like him too tough.
Yeah, I know
him
he didn't.
Du Bois clashed him.
But he brought those pictures for him, and that's how we got, look, some of that garbage and some of that trauma that's that our point. People that's had good. To endure. That was Walter
right.
White.
And that's right, Doc. You're right. That's
and some of those pictures are horrible.
Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. And, because, see, what people have a tendency to do when they make, when they implement these kind of tragedies, is forget they do it. Or either say they didn't do that. That ain't true. You know?
Yeah.
Yep. And I mean, even to say that is just is insane. But yeah, Walter White.
And then Doc Rogers, remember too, when you spoke of Fannie Lou Hamer, when the white master was cheating the people out the money, and although Fannie Lou Hamer only had that sixth grade education, she was a very smart woman. And remember when she was adding that money and adding that stuff up and found out how the master was cheating them, and she got his behind.
Right, right, exactly.
Wow, that's good. That's good.
Mm-hmm. You see, you remember, everybody is not going to be famous either that does work. You're not going to get your picture in the encyclopedia. You're not going to be able to be on TV.
No.
But you still would have done and made some powerful contributions to the cause. Like, there's so many that did that.
Yes.
You know, and other, even though somebody else gets the credit, but it was the people behind the scenes that was the cause of that. Like, for instance, Tuskegee Institute. Everybody throws Booker T. Washington's name out there. Booker T. didn't do that. That was some old farmers down there in Tuskegee who wanted to educate their children in a better way, went around and pulled that money together.
Doc, I have a question for you, Doc. What about Melvin Tawson? Because I know he was a socialist, too.
What was
he doing with the farming? Melvin Tawson.
Oh, Carson. Oh, yeah. That was the one that Denzel did that movie for, right?
That's right. A Lincoln man, too.
Yeah, right. And Lincoln. The Great Debaters. Yeah, that was...
That's right.
Oh, Tawson was a powerful brother down in Texas. And plus, he was a writer. He used to write a column called Caviar and Cabbage. And that was a
bomb.
Now, you get where he's going with that, right?
That's right.
Caviar and Cabbage. What he's talking about is that you've got some silk collar people and you got some grassroots people.
That's right.
Which is the caviar is the silk collar, and the cabbage, you know, is the grassroots folk. You know, so he's writing about living in a world where, particularly in the black world, where we're running into these issues with the caviars and the cabbages fighting each other, and they can't get nowhere. That has been a major problem in our community. We just haven't talked, and I mean, it's been going on for a long time. And then that stuff with that light skin, dark skin stuff, man, that has really killed us.
Right.
And it still does. Even to the point that we fall victim to ourselves. There are a lot of people that might be of light complexion that don't feel that dark-skinned people are smart.
Right.
You know? I mean, let's call a spade a spade.
Yes. Yeah, but you know what I read? They say the blacker you are, the smarter that pituitary gland, the smarter you are.
Right. It's like like Wallace Stearman, the writer, said, the blacker the bird, the sweeter the juice.
Yeah. Ain't no secret.
Yeah. So it's and that too is another way of understanding, because they were writing about that. They were writing about that in the 1920s. That Wallace Stillman's book, Black of the Berry, is about that light-skinned, dark-skinned stuff.
Yes, it is.
There's a book by Nella Larson called Passing.
And didn't that Jim Crow, too, use that mess?
Yeah.
Yeah, they use that, too, to pin the lights against the black.
Right. So those are things that have been stopping us from being sometimes the kind of activists that we might want to be. But it didn't stop Randolph. It didn't stop Garvey. Garvey, that was a real problem for him. It didn't stop them. They knew that these issues were there, but they kept on going at it. And I think that's the message for us today. You got to keep on keeping on. You know, you can't give up.
Secret.
It's like the song said, keep your eyes on the prize.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah, and we have to do that. I think we're going to begin to see there's going to be more and more and more and more of that's needed. In this country. And like I said, we can pull these characters out, and that's one of the things I want to do. I want to sort of isolate some of these heroes and sheroes like that who were unsung heroes. They didn't get the credit that, you know, as I said, the Malcolms, the Martins had got. You know, and when I say credit, I mean understanding of their work and the level of their work and what it meant. They didn't get that. Murray McLeod Bethune wasn't the first one to want to educate poor black farmers. There was another lady named Lucy Laney did the same thing. She educated Murray McLeod Bethune.
Wow. That's right.
And you know
what? One of our dormitories at Lincoln is called Lucy Laney.
Yeah.
People didn't know about her.
That's right.
Our dormitories is called Lucy Laney. Yep.
And the whole thing about reparations. The reparations movement started in the 1700s. You know?
Isn't it?
So that's sometimes what history can tell us. That's what Malcolm said. You know, history is that discipline that best rewards our research. That quote he has, and it's true. If you want to understand anything, you got to look at the history of it.
Yes, and these are the stories our children need to hear.
Reveal sometimes the way to do it. Any closing thoughts, Brother Timothy and Sister Dee Dee? You're all one. We didn't have that many people online because I guess a lot of folks didn't know we were going to be on there. I appreciate people like you, Mr. Lush, Brother Lush, and Brother Griffin, as a lot of folks on the internet. I looked on the internet and I really appreciate
it. Well, I texted Brother Lush and told him to be on tonight.
Oh, okay, good. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I sure did hit up Brother Lush.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing. Any closing thoughts, Brother Timothy?
Well, my closing thought is someone who talked about is Howard Cruz. How do we come together in order to slay the dragon of evil?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that in the slaying the dragon of evil, we have to have an economic and political and social system that we all can feed off of.
Right.
And that one good big think tank, that black think tank, you got all that going on, you got to have thinkers.
Right.
See, mm-hmm. these are the mechanisms of how, see, let me tell you something. The reason why they use white supremacy the way that they always do is because we excel on a basketball court, we excel on a football field,
right.
We excel with a PhD, we excel with a lawyer, we excel as being plumbers and electricians. So all the white man got is psychological warfare,
mm-hmm.
is white supremacy, which
mm-hmm.
also becomes physical.
Very
That's
good.
Why he uses it so hard. Can you believe a man like Trump is still talked about? Because guess what?
Mm-hmm.
All they got is white supremacy. They're still talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
All
That's right.
white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And talking about voting for him in 4 years.
That's right. That's right.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Or replacing with somebody like him. And white supremacy is still strong. Because guess what? The money's there, the
1%.
That's right.
The
that's amazing.
Sister Dee Dee, you
are. And the government's working with him. The government's working with him.
Right.
He's a criminal and a murderer. He's a criminal and a murderer.
That's not even in there.
Okay. Well, listen, folks, that's it for tonight. We will be back on next Tuesday. Brother Kwasi Kraft will be on next Thursday. And obviously, don't
forget. Yes, I will.
All right. Don't forget our Saturday program at 3 o'clock East Central Time and at 6 o'clock Central Time on Saturday. We the Elders Council of Milwaukee talks. And so we look forward to it. Thank you so much again for your support. We're going to let the reggae singer Alpha Blondie take us home, and we will see you back here next Tuesday. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you,
family. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Love y'all,
family. Deus é mais, Bahia de todos santos. Deus é mais, vigai com Deus. Deus é mais, vigai com Deus.
Nhama, 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 salte. Nhama, 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 salte. Nhama, 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 salte. Nhama, 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 salte.
On fait le show, on fait le show à Bahia. On fait le show
à Salvador de Bahia.
On fait le show, on fait le show à Bahia. On fait le show
à Salvador de Bahia.
Les filles sont canons dans leur petit caleçon. Les seins nus au soleil font frémir nos arcs-en-ciel. Elles sont sexy et patate.
Show.